It's a pleasure to introduce Peter Jones from Yale. He's going to talk about the eigenfunction local coordinates and the local Riemann mapping theorem.
Okay, thanks very much. So here's the title of my talk, and as Carrie kindly pointed out, it doesn't make any sense. So what I want to convince you is that it actually makes sense, and it's saying something very simple. I have some pictures, and so this is supposed to be a very introductory talk. I'm not going to spend much time on techniques. I want to show you some pictures related to the methods, and I hope you will ask many questions, because probably very few of you have taken 7 semesters of complex variables. Well, maybe you all have, but I rather doubt that. And that's somehow not the point. And then I want to point out that there's a large group of co-workers in this general Yale diffusion geometry group. This in particular is going to work with Mauro Maggioni and Ranan Shul. And of course, I want to thank IPAM staff and program organizers. So I cannot tell a lie. I'm actually the one who proposed this program in its proto form. In other words, I didn't have a proposal. And my proposal was that Carrie Preeb would write it. And I had invented this word document space for reasons maybe I could explain afterwards, but that it's an offline conversation. And it might not make any sense to anyone but me, but I had a coherent reason based on my background in harmonic analysis. Okay, so I also want to point out that there are talks by Mauro and Stefan Lafon on this. So this is, in a certain sense, putting the cart before the horse. And because of that, I'm going to have Mauro come in and show you some of the pictures that appear in his presentation, so that we have some sort of anchor to think about. And this will actually be some pictures of texts, amongst other things. But I want to talk about mathematical algorithms. So one of the ideas here is so many vampires, so few silver bullets. Right? So there are many, many enemies out there. There's no silver bullet that will kill all the vampires. And I want to give you an example of this. One of the great contributions of linear methods in statistics, etc., is principal components analysis. And one of the brilliant ideas of principal components analysis, now you have to imagine that you live in 28 dimensions. And for the people right back there, this is your data set, and you can't see anything. So of course the answer is you're supposed to go like this. You change coordinates simply, or you also do some dimensional reduction. But while that is a great technique and extremely valuable, it has enemies. So there are places where this simply won't lead you to a useful representation of your data. And I guess I don't want to steal the thunder from one of our speakers this afternoon, but one of the speakers is talking about why document space is like an elephant. Suppose you are an elephant, and that really is your, or that is your data set. Principal components will do a pretty bad job on an elephant representing it, except maybe on the trunk if the trunk is extended. If the trunk is wrapped around the tusk, it will do a very poor job. And maybe you should look for other methods. So one of the central ideas in diffusion geometry is really not to think of doing clustering. Maybe you want to do clustering at the end, but simply to put new coordinates on a data set. So you're giving them a data set, maybe the representation you have of it is very difficult to understand, but if you change coordinates, you could do something analogous to this, and then you might be able to work with it. So now this idea of putting on different coordinates is, of course, a very old one in mathematics. There are various ways to do it. And I want to talk about one of the oldest one of these, which is the Riemann mapping theorem. It's actually a principle from electrostatics, where electrostatics will automatically put a surprising coordinate chart on certain sets. And this was discovered by Riemann. It took a long time to give a rigorous proof. By the way, the big advance in this field was after giving a proof by electricity, people were able to give a proof by water, that something called the Riemann mapping theorem existed. And it took a good time for a rigorous proof to come out. But of course, the rigorous proof says exactly what the proofs by water and electricity will say. So then there will be a theorem. And now the theorem is I think, really only useful in the following sense. If you have a method, you would, perhaps the method is useful, perhaps it is not. Can you rely on it? Maybe yes, maybe no. And it may depend upon the situation. If you have a theorem that tells you that the method does X, then you can check to see if X is going to be useful in the application you're looking at, and it will also tell you what are the enemies. So principal components analysis, for example, has some very simple enemies, like the wrapped elephant trunk. Then there'll be a discussion of heat kernels. It turns out you don't have to know what a heat kernel is. You only have to have a heavy binging experience with alcohol to know what a random walk is. Then you will actually know everything. And then what do I mean by good eigenfunctions? Things that look like sine theta and cosine theta. Okay, and Koifman theta. That's usually a very complicated coordinate. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so at this point, we come to topic one, and I'm going to ask Mauro to show some of his slides, and then we'll return to these pictures that he's going to show and just discuss sort of why we see certain things.
Right, so actually these figures, most of us have already seen it in Raffi's talk, and figures due to Stefan. And it's kind of an idealized situation in which we have a scatter set of points, which are the green dots, and it illustrates, I think, very well what's the difference between what we call diffusion distance and what is geodesic distances. So suppose you, and also illustrates the possibility of applications to grouping of objects, because you can think of this picture as a very idealized situation in which you have two clusters of, for example, documents, but here documents are intended in a very general way, which are weakly connected by some documents which have some relationships to both sides of the groups of documents. And when we saw this picture in Raffi's talk, what was the main observation? The main observation is the following. And so suppose you have this set of points, and when at this point you can look at them, they're just a 2D picture, so you can look and you will say, I see two groups of related points which are weakly connected. You will say, I see two clusters or two groups. And well, how are you going to measure similarities for distances between points on this, between two points on this set? Well, let's look at the points A, B, C, and suppose you want to look at the distance between A and B and C and B. And if you look at the geodesic distance, so the distance of the shortest path connecting a pair of points, well, maybe not with the scaling that I have on this slide, but you can think that you can see that the geodesic distance between A and B is pretty close to the geodesic distance between B and C. They're certainly comparable. On the other hand, you would like to say that B and C are much more similar. They belong to the same group. and B and A are much farther away. And how can you quantify that? Mm-hmm. And the observation is, well, don't use Judy's distance. Judy's distance is too smart. It's going to go and pick the shortest path between A and B. But that path is very unlikely. It's hard to find because it has to go through that bottleneck. So instead of picking the shortest path, look at all the paths connecting a pair of points and use a kind of diffusion process. Think of starting at B, diffuse. And when you diffuse, you're going to reach C in a much faster and along many more paths of comparable lengths than the time that it's going to take you to diffuse from B and A. There are much fewer paths, much smaller conductance in some sense along those paths. And so while visualistic distance is telling you very little about the structure of the set, diffusion distance is going to tell you much more about that. We saw the same argument in Michael's talk on the very first day of his workshop, in which he was embedding this kind of dumbbell graph with few points by using geodesic distances through isomet, if I remember correctly, or by using diffusion distance and using algorithms. And just to give you a feeling of how eigenfunctions look like on a 3D version of a previous set, these pictures are also by Stefan, and I think we might see them again tomorrow. So this is a 3D manifold, and I'm coloring points based on the value of the eigenfunction of the dumbbell. And you can see that these functions are global, oscillating. They have some frequency content, one oscillations, two oscillations, and more oscillations, like a sine, a cosine, in the different symmetry directions of the manifold. And on the right-hand side, we're mapping this manifold by using these eigenfunctions as coordinates on the manifold, and this is what the talk would be about, and this is how the manifold is being mapped by using the top three eigenfunctions. And the main observation here is that, first of all, Euclidean distance in this picture corresponds not to Riemannian distances or geodesic distance in the original space, but to diffusion distances in the original space. So the two dumbbells here are getting farther apart because the diffusion distance between two sides of the dumbbell is very large. And then I wanted to say that we can prove theorems for domains in Rn and there are extensions to manifolds. How is that relevant to data sets? Well, we don't have theorems yet there, but actually you can apply the same technique to very high dimensional data sets, to graphs. And here I picked, and I will be talking more about this tomorrow, this is a body of documents. I have 1,000 documents, 10,000 words for each. I have a matrix of word frequencies, and I can think of this cloud of 1,000 points in 10,000 dimensions. I can connect nearby documents by similarity, and I can compute the eigenfunctions and use them to embed. And these are the kind of features that I get. And definitely some structures which are nonlinear, like, I don't know the English word that you use for the... So these are nonlinear structures, kind of... But it would be very hard to pick up with a linear algorithm like PCA. They get preserved, and I can get very low-dimensional representations of these bodies of documents. And tomorrow I'll be telling you more about what do you do after this.
And they do get preserved. And
they do get preserved, and then...
The one thing that's never, that you can't answer, and so it's to your credit that you never do, is whether we want them preserved or not.
Yep, so the argument would be that these distances are somehow more meaningful than, say, trying to preserve other distances. And one hint that it's good to preserve them is here, what are the colors of the points or labels that were given to this document? And the fact that the labels don't get very mixed is telling me that these distances are actually preserved the groups of similar documents, where similar is also meaningful because these groups are not mixed up.
Right,
together.
But it's whether the nonlinear structure, some of it doesn't appear to necessarily be preserved in order to keep the
true.
Right, and
yep.
So that's unfortunately.
Yep. I don't even know which kind of claim one could make about that.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And I would like to pass the ball back.
So maybe Peter.
Yeah. So this is your first example.
I'm sorry. I have a question. Could you go back to the eigenfunctions there?
The ones.
That's right. So. Tell me again about this. This is a sequence of...
Yeah, so there is on the left-hand side, there is one manifold, which is this 3D dumbbell. And we approximate the Laplace-Beltrami operator on that manifold.
Maybe
and we compute
at this point, because I hear difficult words. My first slide is going to be an explanation of this rather strange picture.
Okay, well.
And so the point is, somehow you have a shape and you bang it as if it were a drum. You listen to it and you separate out the fundamental frequencies. This is what you do with a piano. These are representations of the fundamental frequencies that you hear when you bang it. And you get a particular shape for each one. So for example,
modes.
So if you hit a piano string, one mode might look like this, another mode might look like this. Those happen to be related to what are called eigenfunctions.
Yeah, but the point is that the color is coding the
value of the eigenfunction.
Yeah, but I guess, are you going to explain how the eigenfunctions lead to this mapping that you're constructing?
Yes.
You are, right?
Yes, that's going to be the point.
So we're looking here at six eigenfunctions.
Yes.
Right. So what the first question is?
And they all have the same shape, but different amplitudes, so to speak?
Color.
So what does color mean? Color
is the value of the function. So the manifold is fixed and it's the dumbbell.
The manifold is fixed.
And it's the dumbbell.
Okay.
And there's a function on it.
So
thanks for the translation.
I think three people with accents should speak slowly.
So there is a function on that manifold. There are several functions on that manifold. Each eigenfunction is one such function.
Yes.
And I'm representing that function by the color on that manifold. So the fact that, say, the fourth eigenfunction is blue here, it means that it's roughly, say, -1. And then it moves here, and it's red, so it means that the eigenfunction there is +1. And so on. So the color represents the function on a fixed manifold.
The manifold is fixed, and these are functions on the manifold.
Functions on the manifold.
What do they help you do in the end? They help you represent one.
They will talk with you about how they help you parameterizing this manifold.
So, by the way, so for those of you who don't know what a manifold is, let me show you what a manifold is. How about the line, a line segment?
Somebody put on the light again.
I will put on the light, yes. Okay, so think of a line segment, and then you might say, well, you know, you're in pretty bad shape if you don't know how to put coordinates on this, right? However, let us notice that there are some elementary functions. So if this is 0 and this is 1, I'm trying to draw a sine of pi x. First mode, okay? And then here we have sine of 2x and 2 pi x. Sine 3 pi x, etc. And we're going to talk about now maybe surfaces or higher dimensional things and functions that are analogous to this, and ask the question, it's like Admiral Stockdale, why am I here? Right? what is any of this good for? Okay, so actually this picture is...
One more question.
Please.
What was the lower right thing? I don't know.
The lower
right? Let's go back to that beautiful picture. That you gave that man.
Oh, that's an embedding.
Yes, that's going to be
a new
coordinate. So we're going to use the eigenfunctions to parameterize the old manifold in a way that the old talk would be about that.
So imagine
and this is how the image under both coordinate mapping is going to be.
Okay, so how does that mean you're going to compute these eigenfunctions in my dimension?
So you're going to solve the equation? So we approximate, so we have this couple of points and we build that graph out of that with weights in such a way that we get an approximation of the Laplacian triangle of that manifold. And then we just use an eigensolver to put it in.
Yeah, so to return to the analogy of an elephant, suppose you're a blind man confronted with a dumbbell, like a mathematician, okay? You may have a different mental representation of that dumbbell. You may view the two dumb parts of it, the bells, as being farther apart than they physically are. Okay? This is a coordinate change that will do that. We'll see much simpler coordinate changes in just a minute, but please don't let me shut off questions.
Is it the first three functions which are used to embed?
Yes.
Right, so then you can see, right, why the first function is this direction, why it separates the two dumbbells, and then the next two separate each of those discs.
Correct. And one question you might ask here is, why was it that these functions, whatever they are, happen to have the property that they gave any reasonable representation of the dumbbell? Maybe these functions are just junk, and you get nothing. And so now the discussion is going to be why they must carry certain geometric information.
Another question. If there are three functions, why are there six pictures?
Oh, because he didn't get tenure yet, so you have to produce more eigenfunctions. Oh, the answer is simply you want to look at the other eigenfunctions. You have to choose amongst eigenfunctions. Perhaps the top three are great for your purpose, but bad for your purpose. And it may be that the next three are good. This is very much like principal component analysis, where the three top coordinates may be great for you, but not for you. And he's only interested in some sort of outlier that would not appear in those first coordinates. So it's nice to keep hold of all the information.
So is there some interpretations analogously to it in terms of PCA, that if the data come from something nice like a Gaussian distribution, then the axes mean something?
Yes. Oh, that's exactly what we're, where this is what we're going to come to.
Yeah, and you're going to explain why you're choosing Laplace Beltrami as opposed to some other operator.
Yes. So my first defense is I'm a mathematician, I may do whatever I please. Okay. But of course there has to be a real reason. So I will attempt to answer that. But I think there's still a few mysteries.
Right, you won't answer it to my satisfaction. I know that.
So that would be impossible.
Right.
But no, maybe I will.
Okay.
We'll see. Because so everyone knows how to put coordinates on the unit interval, just call it x between 0 and 1. But how are you going to do this on the unit circle? So of course you learn in high school that you represent a point as cosine theta comma sine theta. Okay. So the point is coordinates, beautiful, perfect coordinates, are actually given by these two functions. You get an x and a y coordinate. And that's how you should view any closed curve. For example, you could try and put those coordinates on it. These happen to be eigenfunctions of a Laplace operator also. It's not a mistake. So let's get a little terminology here. So I could pick a patch of the circle and say, well, I would like to represent this patch as an interval. That seems like a reasonable thing to do. Which one should I use? Let's see, I shouldn't use the x coordinate because there'll be two points identified here. But if I use the y coordinate here, that's pretty good, right? So then I would just project onto this interval. Okay? So a nice local coordinate patch here is sine theta, which is the y coordinate. Okay. However, if I go up here, I have to reverse this and use cosine theta. So the point is, I would need, if I wanted to represent the circle as consisting of intervals with nice representations, I would choose four intervals. So I'd choose that one, its antipode, and then I would take something like the cosines on those two other intervals. I get four intervals. And how do you decide if this is a good representation? So let's not worry too much. Biliterous is supposed to mean good, but what it means is if we have two sets here, and we have a mapping from this picture to that picture, and we take two points on here, we have some metric here, suppose it's Euclidean, and then we get points f of x and f of y. We'd like a faithful representation so that if x is close to y, f of x is close to y. If x is far from y, f of x should be far from y. So the way we express this is that we would like the distance from f of x to f of y to look like x minus y. So we would have two constants, a and b, which is bigger than 0, so that for all x and y, we neither stretch too much nor compress too much. Okay? So that this is just a mathematician's way of saying this is a coordinate chart that has certain nice estimates, so that things may be rotated, but they're not bent out of shape too much. Okay, so just to go back here, the point is if you check out on this interval here, the action of sine theta is a mapping onto, say, this interval, it's easy to check because the derivative of sine is cosine. Cosine is big, but not too big. Well, so then it's easy to write down A and B here, and you have a pretty nice representation. Mercator would have been unhappy with this, but okay. And then, as we said before, we get four nice coordinate patches, but this idea has an enemy. The enemy is exactly the circle. We can't write down one function that will work for the whole circle, because you can't turn a circle into an interval, not maintaining some sort of nice distance relationship. So that just means you have to chop it up into pieces. It would be bad if we had to do this into 1,000 pieces. Then it wouldn't be a very useful representation. So if we now go to the unit square, or what mathematicians would call the torus, then you just need an x-coordinate and a y-coordinate. And if you're on torus, you might need cosines also. But just think of the square. And then we have sine of m pi x times sine of n pi y. So where did I pull these out of? Well, I could say I just pulled them out of a hat, but it turns out that there's a natural differential equation, the Laplace equation, which likes these functions. So think of the Laplacian as in two dimensions, you take the second derivative of x and the second derivative with respect to y. Or except there's a convention, we might put a minus sign in front of it. And so then if we apply this to a function phi, that's called Laplacian phi, there are special functions where you just recover the function with a lambda. This is exactly what happens when you bang a drum. The frequencies that you hear are actually coming from these special eigenfunctions. This tells you the pitch. The lambda just tells you the pitch. Okay, and these are somehow very natural coordinates. These can be very complicated. So that's a pre-Euclidean coordinate system. Right? The Greeks knew everything about this. This is a domain in the plane, and then this is a drawing of one of these eigenfunctions. They can be wickedly complicated, and this one is kind of a marvel. This picture stretches on to infinity in both directions. So this is to give you an idea that these things could be pretty complicated, but if you had a budget large enough to build a drum that looked like that and you hit it correctly, I guarantee you, you will hear that sound. You will need a large budget to do that. Okay, so we're going to look at functions that are a little more complicated than sine, cosine, but they are generated in some natural way. Okay, so now we come to what mathematicians regard as a change of coordinates number one. This is a very special theorem. It's only a theorem that applies in two dimensions. So what is the theorem? So we take, say, a Jordan curve here, and our domain is the boundary, and then we fix a base point. That's the point we're interested in. We want a global coordinate chart for this whole domain that, oh, and something happened here. Zero got moved. So we could do that if we want, it turns out. This is supposed to be in, right there in the center. We want to map this to the center, and how do you do this? So you should think of the following. We take this picture, imagine that the boundary is somehow elastic. We pull it out in some way, and if we keep pulling it out, it should go into a circle. There are lots of ways to do that, and then there is a preferred way, which is called the Riemann mapping. It has a very special representation. So F is what's called analytic. It has a power series representation. Let's not go into all the details about that. It's still possible to get tenure studying Riemann mappings, but it's getting harder. Okay. So this mapping is the mapping preferred by electrostatics. It produces it automatically. That's a remarkable fact. So what Riemann understood was, to get this mapping, I'm actually going to do an inversion. So I'll put this point at infinity, and instead of looking at the inside of a curve, I'll look outside the curve. And then I do the following amazing thing. I just turn the wire here into gold. I pull a comb out. Well, I can't do this, but most people in the audience can. So you get a charge from static electricity. You tap on the wire. And what happens? So the electrons go to a configuration of minimal energy. They're trying to escape from each other, but they're constrained to live on this gold wire. So they immediately run there. Now, amazingly, that was the step that was hard to prove, that there really was a minimum energy configuration. And this just made the physicists very frustrated with the mathematicians because they said, just do it in a laboratory. Okay, but that's what happens. And then it turns out that charge distribution produces a potential field outside of the curve. And then the Riemann mapping is just given by looking at a level line of that, and that's mapped to a circle, a round circle around there. So there's a beautiful electrostatic principle. Of course, you might say, well, there are lots of other mappings. You know, any child can take this and stretch a rubber boundary in any way possible, and there are many, many ways to distort that region to that. Why should I look at this one? What is magical about it? Okay, so this then is my UCLA graduate training with John Garnett. So there's, wait a minute, so where'd it go?
But we blame John Garnett for this.
Oh yeah. No, okay. No, so we don't blame John Garnett yet. Okay. It comes later, and then so the theorem is the following. We're given this region now, but think of this as a data set. This is a data set or a manifold. Okay. You want to put a coordinate chart on it. by magic, because maybe you don't know how to do it. So you might try PCA, maybe that's not good. So you select a point, this red point, and you draw a ball around it. How big a ball? Well, you say, well, I won't go all the way to the boundary. I'll go about halfway, and I'll see if there's a nice coordinate chart there. Now, what is the most reasonable coordinate chart? You'd like to blow this up to the unit ball, to size 1, automatically. Okay? Now, remember, this may be a very complicated object. This is a surface flying around R5, for example. How are you going to do this? You certainly won't be able to do this by hand. You'll need some help. So the theorem says the following, that if I make the natural restriction, that I pick a point, I don't go too close to the boundary, then I'm going to produce, I'll come to that in just a second. I'm going to produce a canonical mapping that will give me a very large image with small distortion. So the way we do this is we pick certain of these so-called eigenfunctions. Those are functions that satisfy this equation. And if I pick D of them, where D is the ambient dimension, then I will get a local coordinate chart. So that just means a one-to-one mapping with estimates. And the image is blown up to the size that a human being would like to look at it on, in other words, 1. So there's a strange restriction here. Volume has to be 1. So I think God sees all domains as having volume 1, actually, so we're probably lucky. Yes, I'm...
We're fine,
okay.
Quizzing here.
Okay, but that, this is a good place to stop and just look at the picture and ask if there are any questions. Okay? So what you should think of is you don't... Now, on a data set, there really is no boundary. So imagine this just being a data set. So this is designed for that case also, and then you have to make some, there's a reasonable way to decide the size of the ball. And exactly the enemy was, well, if your data set looks like the unit circle, you better not, so that you're going to prescribe one function that goes all the way around and gives you because that's simply impossible. What could you hope for? Half of it? No. But more than a quarter of it? Yes. Okay. So we'll get locally a big piece, which works. Okay. This is a technical slide. So there are different types of eigenfunctions. If you're an expert, there are Dirichlet eigenfunctions. These vanish on the boundary. Neumann eigenfunctions, these have normal derivative that vanish on the boundary. Both of them have a description in terms of random walkers. And we'll come to the random walk description. In the first case, let's go back. In the first case, your random walker starts in here, and it's just like the little red dot, it starts jiggling. When it hits the boundary, it stops, it's absorbed. In the second case, it jiggles, it hits the boundary, but then it bounces back in. So those are two types of random walks. It turns out they lead to slightly different types of eigenfunctions, and the theorem I'm talking about is very flexible. It doesn't care which one. You pick a category, and it will provide you coordinates, but I should underline that in diffusion geometry, these are Neumann boundary values because you don't really know where the boundary of your data set is. That's not a meaningful thing. It's not a meaningful thing. Things just bounce around. Or think of a graph where there is no boundary. You just walk around the graph. Okay, so why this restriction on the volume? Well, it turns out that the most trivial example of square has estimates that are bad because these eigenfunctions become very small, so they can't possibly blow up anything to size 1. They're bounded by size 4 L to the minus 1. Okay. So there is a restriction. Okay, now we come to my graduate training. So let us go and look at what the people in electrostatics knew all along. Okay. So these have a fancy name in math. It's called the distortion theorem. And that's nice because it means there's no distortion. So the thing you're worrying about doesn't happen. So what is the point? So let's look at this Riemann mapping. There's this preferred mapping. I get to choose a base point, say the center of this orange circle, and I'm going to map the whole green domain onto the unit disk, and I'm going to say, I'm interested in what's going on here. So there's a way to map that point to the origin, and then what happens to a disk whose radius is, say, 1/2 the distance to the boundary? So it comes close to the boundary, but it doesn't hit it. The answer is this mapping is almost linear. And it's not just almost linear, it's almost a multiple of a rotation. So it just looks like putting a magnifying glass here, just blowing it up to unit size, and maybe rotating it. Okay? And if you want to get rid of the rotation, you can do that by post-composing with another rotation. Okay, so it turns out, so a way of quantifying this is that these are by Lipschitz. That just means the distortion is extremely low. There's a magnification, but there's no distortion. And the crucial thing is you have brought this area up to size 1, where a human being can look at it, and there may be something else there he's interested in looking at if it's a data set. Okay? So it's automatically blown it up. This is exactly the result I want to talk about. So think of exactly the same picture, but now I'm going to pick two eigenfunctions which will give approximately the same map on this region. Okay. And then you can ignore all the fancy names down here. That's a way of saying that someone needed tenure in the 1920s. Okay, so let's go back and look at this Riemann mapping. So this is some sort of mathematical justification. Let me draw a picture here. So our mission is to map something to the unit disk. Something like this. And we want to map this point to the origin, and I want, therefore, the mapping on here to go something like here. How do I understand this mapping? So it turns out the mapping has a closed formula in terms of electrostatics. And the electrostatic description, it turns out, has a very simple description, a closed formula given in terms of random walk. So if you have this mapping that does that, you have a function f of z. So the first step is to look at the absolute value of that. And the way you understand this is that the logarithm of the absolute value of f of z is what's called Green's function. So this, you could even take this as a definition, though I don't recommend it. So G stands for green. There's a canonical function that blows up like a logarithm here. It's harmonic everywhere else, and it's zero on the boundary. So this is actually what you get from an electric potential. You have a sink and a source, and so we have these lines. So what happens here is if we take a circle here, it goes to almost a circle there, and then this is part of the coordinate chart, and actually a coordinate chart would be given by taking G plus, there's some operator you do on G by looking at the gradient of it, let's not define it, and that gives you a coordinate chart here. So the point is we know that this mapping comes from what's called this Green's function, and so what does this have to do with banging a drum? So K is what's called the heat kernel. You start a random walker in your domain at this point. He walks around, and then you look at the probability density that starting at time t, he's wandered over there, but that he hasn't hit the boundary. Eventually everything will fly out. And then that function, special function, has a closed formula. You fix a base point z naught, that's where you start wandering. You pick a point z, and you just compute the densities that are given here at time t and integrate from 0 to infinity. Now, if you think of this on the line, it turns out, in Euclidean space, you're just integrating out a Gaussian distribution. These are Gaussians. They have a closed formula. It's just your friend from statistics 101. So K is called the heat kernel because this has something to do with heat diffusion. And now there's a miraculous and beautiful formula for the heat kernel in terms of these eigenfunctions, that it is the sum over all eigenfunctions, which I call phi sub j of x, phi sub j of y, times e to the minus lambda t. So this is a function that vanishes at the boundary. And so here I did it with what's called Dirichlet eigenvalues. The main point is that there's some formula that we're not going to use. So we won't use this formula at all. We're just going to use it as a guide. And I want to tell you how this project started for me. So I call it anger management, because I've seen the beautiful pictures from Kreufmann's group, and they were unrealistically good. Right? That, you know, you would accuse any graduate student of having manufactured these with a paintbrush at home and then scanned them onto a computer and said, look at the experiment I ran last night. Why are these coordinates so unreasonably good? And so then I started working with Mauro and Ronan, and the starting point is to go back to, because we're mathematicians, to go back to what we thought we understood and say, let's re-examine it. Maybe we were thinking about the wrong thing. So this is just the first step. There's our friend the heat kernel in the plane. It's just the Gaussian. Okay. So you take the Gaussian, and then there's a huge debate. Should you take it with variance t or 2t? That's too difficult for me. There are different schools, but we take the Gaussian. And now let's just give a kind of metaphorical point of view. So here's something the spectral graph theorists, of course, were working with a long time ago. I had in one of my earlier slides that I couldn't give the history or do justice to it, but of course one of the central observations of spectral graph theory was these local coordinates come from studying random walk, which means studying something called heat kernel graph. And So the heat kernel, just think of the Gaussian, should play a central role in any kind of proof. And here's a very simple observation that if we go back to this thing, we have a closed formula. We can compute everything about this function. We compute its gradient, we can compute its second derivative with respect to x, y. Anything you want can be computed. So it's our friend. And heat kernels on graphs or manifolds are closely approximated by your good old friend the Gaussian, if you're careful enough about which times you're using and the distance between various points. So then the idea is we should look at the heat kernel. We should write the heat kernel in terms of eigenfunctions. And now we want to use a pigeonhole principle and recurse on directions. Okay. So let's go back to everyone's friend, the pigeonhole principle. The pigeonhole principle says that if you have a small number of boxes and a large number of pigeons, someone will get a big dinner. Okay. And we're just going to use this. We're going to have a small number of boxes. We're going to have a large number of eigenfunctions. And one of those eigenfunctions will therefore sit in the correct box. Okay. Also, it turns out there are ways to count how many eigenfunctions there are. This is an old theorem called Weyl's theorem. It says that if you know something about the volume of the manifold and the dimension d, there's a way to count how many eigenfunctions and therefore eigenvalues there are less than any given value, and it looks like the volume of the domain or manifold times the number t to a power d over 2. And you can verify this by just looking at a square. Or if you want to, just look at it on an interval with the functions sine and theta and easily verify how many there are, because if I take sine kx and I differentiate twice, I get, notice there's a minus sign, I get minus k squared sine x. How many integers, positive integers, are that such that k squared is less than t? Square root of t. Okay, so there's some nice counting theorem about these eigenfunctions. There aren't too many low modes. Any piano player knows this, by the way, right? There are only so many low notes you can hit. Okay. And now the proof of this theorem is actually most easily given by studying the heat kernel. Okay, now we come to some technicalities. Okay, so these are to impress you. There they are. Oh, we have estimates. That's supposed to impress you even more. And there's linear algebra. So let me go to the linear algebra at the end. Okay? Because linear algebra has to be our friend and our enemy. So let me show you a bad way to pick a coordinate system. And this is something I learned from this problem. Suppose we try to put a coordinate system on R2. Okay, let's consider the function xy. So if we take the x derivative, this is y. That's big. So that means that if, for example, I'm up here, I'm seeing a lot of action and I'm differentiating the values of x in this direction. Okay? Let's take the derivative with respect to y. That's x. Well, if I'm at this point again, so this is 1, 1, then I'm seeing a lot of action somehow in this direction. And therefore, one function has given me a coordinate system in R2. This is nonsense, right? It's impossible. So So what is the answer? I mean, you should really look at the gradient, which is preferred. And then, see, unfortunately, there's a direction in their directions in which x, y is constant. So if you go in that direction, you're not getting any information. So you have to do some linear algebra. You pick a direction you want an eigenfunction to aim at, and now you do the following. So at this point, I just draw a picture. So let's pretend, in fact, that we're one-dimensional. And I'm looking at some point x naught. I'm going to put a point x over here. Actually, I'll reverse this. So I have a point x. This is x naught. And I'm going to look for a local coordinate patch around here. Let's use the Gaussian. So let's just draw the Gaussian with center at x naught. This is the center. So this is the Gaussian function. Let me make the variance in the following way. So the variance should be x minus x naught squared, because then the Gaussian is approximately constant on this scale, right? Because in time t, how far does a Brownian walker go? Square root of t. Okay, so there's some natural homogeneity. And so there's the Gaussian. Most of it is here. So the Gaussian will then look roughly like, let's see, we're on the line. It'll look like 1 over x naught minus x in this region. And then, of course, it decays very rapidly. Now, the point is, at this point, if I choose the distance correctly, I see that ddx of the Gaussian, I really should use now the heat kernel, because it's not degrees function, at the appropriate time t, which is this, is large. And how large is it? It's like, in this case, it's like 1 over r squared. Okay. Now I do the following. I just go back and say, okay, I take the gradient of the heat kernel. So on my manifold, if I pick the right time, it will look exactly like the Euclidean heat kernel. And so I can actually cheat. It's legal to use this estimate and say, well, the gradient is large. Now we take our true heat kernel, we expand it, and we notice that high frequencies don't play big role here. So there's a size. It turns out you can throw away the high frequencies and get a very good approximation. And also you get a beautiful approximation to the gradient. Okay. And so now we just look at this representation. We take only the lower frequencies, and there are not very many of them. We have a rule that counts them. And then if you muck around, you discover, oh, one of them has to be large. The gradient is large. And then you say, oh, that's good. And then you discover, if you're just a little more careful, that the gradient is large, the second derivative is small. That means it looks like a linear mapping. Almost linear in one direction. Okay. So this is how to pick out one coordinate, is by just looking at the sum and looking for the correct size derivative on the inside. Let me just, Emin was showing you, so okay, so there's some way of doing this. So here's an example. That example is, the square.
Yes.
And these are just sine mx, sine my. Okay, and then you have these nice pictures. Okay. Here's a real example where one tries to do this. So here's a complicated domain. Now this domain is even a little challenging for those who have taken 7 courses in complex analysis, because this Riemann mapping theorem is only when the boundary is one curve. If there are two curves, it's not correct. So there are replacements. It's still hard to get tenure studying them, but because people study a lot, but it gets harder. Okay? And then here are two of the eigenfunctions on this domain. So I guess it's the domain has been rotated, and we're looking at two sort of strange-looking eigenfunctions. And so these are the ones that will give nice local coordinates here, and they will blow things up exactly to the size of the unit ball, except for universal constants. Let's see. Oh. And I just exited my presentation, so perfect. So.